is a time for the evening under starlight, a time for the evening under lamplight, the evening with the photograph album. Welcome, and once again you are invited to attend to Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105 Community Radio in your city with me, Robert Louis Abrahamson. You know, in Shakespeare's day, people did not go to see a play. The expression they used was that they went to hear a play. That's an interesting shift in wording. But here on Evening Under Lamplight, we do not ask you to hear the show or listen to it, but to attend, or attend to the show. The French would say assister, to assist at the event. And yes, by attending to the show, you are also assisting the show. What is this show without you? Just some self-indulgent havering on my part. So it's you who make it come alive and real. So thank you for coming. It's a pleasure to share this time with you. Remember that you can write to me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.com and find the podcasts of this show and previous shows at momentsunderlamplight.com. Podcasts are also available on the Cambridge105.fm site. And you can subscribe to the podcasts, although with the music cut back to no more than 30 seconds, at iTunes Podcasts. And now, what have we got this evening under lamplight? What photograph albums will we be looking through together? The first thing is not so much a photograph album, but let's say a music album, a community service announcement, in fact. We're entering into the final week of the Cambridge Summer Music Festival. Tomorrow, Wednesday the 30th, there is the last of the very successful Sounds Green concerts held in the Cambridge University Botanical Gardens from 6:15 to 7:30 p.m. This week's concert is performed by Simply Reeds, a quartet of saxophones whose style ranges from light classical and baroque to swing, jazz and modern pop music. Come sit outside in their beautiful gardens, bring a picnic if you'd like. The atmosphere is always relaxed and friendly. On Thursday the 31st, at Emmanuel United Reformed Church at 8 o'clock, you can hear Four Girls, Four Harps. 40 fingers flying over the strings of the four harps as, this is a quotation now, as the four girls take us on a world tour from the Celtic fringes via the Spanish Alhambra to Middle Eastern skies and Far Eastern pagodas. That's quoted directly from the brochure. They know how to put it better than I do. How about an American choir? The Vocalist Chamber Choir from Western New York come to the Church of Our Lady and the English Martyrs at 7:30 on Friday, 1st of August, to present A Journey in Song, American and European Choral Music, Past and Present, with works by Victoria, Palestrina, Bird, Finzi, Vaughan Williams, Eric Whittaker, Samuel Barber, and, so it says here, Dolly Parton. They tell us that they are committed to providing an intimate and moving concert experience that will inspire, educate, and enlighten audiences. I like those three verbs. They should always go together. Inspire, educate, and enlighten. Two more short notices. On Saturday 2nd, the final day of the festival, there are two wonderful events at the Fitzwilliam College Auditorium. First, at 3:30, Harriet McKenzie on violin joins Morgan Szymanski on guitar, two celebrated virtuosi, with a repertoire of classical, Spanish, and Latin American music. Then at 8 p.m., Natalie Klein, a cellist everyone should get to hear and attend to, with Katya Apikisheva on piano and Frederick Paulson on violin, give us Prokofiev's Five Melodies and Preludes, Shostakovich's Cello Sonata, and Tchaikovsky's Piano Trio. To find out more, go to cambridgesummermusic.com or book tickets at 01223-357-851. Let's turn to our readings of A Literary Vagrant. That's one of our photo albums, you remember. Last time, we discussed Devils in Literature – Milton, Blake, Stevenson, Dante. But here's one example I didn't get around to, a book you probably don't know, but it's a writer, James Branch Cabell, who was once very important to me and shaped a lot of the way my imagination works, not to mention shaping my taste for elegant, ironic tone and sentence structure. I want to introduce you to his most famous or most notorious book, Jurgen. By the way, the book's title and the main character's name, spelled J-U-R-G-E-N, ought technically, I suppose, to be pronounced Jurgen. But I think I am in agreement with the general American convention in pronouncing it Jurgen. But first, a bit of background. James Branch Cabell was born into one of the aristocratic families of Virginia in 1879, in a house that later became the Richmond, Virginia Public Library. He graduated from William and Mary College when he was only 19. The story is that he taught Greek and medieval French while he was still a teenage undergraduate. I can't imagine what this would have been like. Perhaps he was allowed to give a few lectures, perhaps he led some seminars, though unless he was able to carry off a great deal of authority and charisma, I can't see that the other undergraduates would have paid him much respect. He was slight and scholarly, not quite of this world. Maybe that's how he could take on the role of the young college professor. But there was another more serious problem during his years at William and Mary. He formed a close friendship with an older professor, and, this being in the years just after the Oscar Wilde trial, he was accused of being too close to that professor and was dismissed from the college. These days it would be the professor who would be dismissed for being too close to a teenage student. But Cabell was allowed back to finish his degree, yet he remained deeply scarred and had nothing to do with academic life after this. Like many aspiring writers, Cabell started off as a journalist. He also, it seems, took on the role, the role of ladies' man, and in his later accounts, he tells of his nighttime escapades with young ladies at fashionable summer resorts, incidents that appear also in various disguises in his fiction. Another scandal arose when, at age 22, he was accused of having murdered a man who was supposed to have been involved with his mother. Maybe this was just what any decent Virginian aristocrat was expected to do in those days, but Cabell was already too cynical to play the expected role. So here he suffered once more from the unjust accusations of the American mob. But he was innocent, and eventually the incident passed over. His short stories began to be published, and then, at age 24, Cabell married a rich widow with 5 children, and he never had to work again. From this point on, he spent his time in his library reading and writing, diverting himself with fantasy stories that illustrated his own satiric, urbane view of the world. He had inherited his uncle's library, a huge collection of esoteric literature, which he drew on for many characters and incidents in the fiction. Many of Cabell's stories and novels are set in the fictional French province Poitem, which is a word made up of the two place names Poitiers and Angoulême. These stories trace the noble families of Poitem from the Middle Ages down through the Georgian period in England to contemporary Virginia. The books slowly grew in popularity. I'll tell you in a minute about the scandal, the next scandal, that really brought him to the public's attention. And Cabell was praised by critics as one of the most important writers of the 20s. I forget who said it, but I remember one critic saying that when all the other writers of our generation, he had in mind people like Hemingway, F. Scott Fitzgerald, when all the other writers of the 20s are forgotten, the name of James Branch Cabell will remain high in the public esteem. But clever writers with playful prose styles in the 1920s soon fell from fashion when things got tough in the 30s and 40s, and Cabell did nothing to shift his style. Why should he? He claimed he was writing primarily to divert himself, and popularity was the last thing he desired. When I was an undergraduate, I sated myself on Cabell's books and, in fact, wrote my undergraduate thesis on him. Here, Indulge me a minute, please. Here is the title of my thesis, of which I was at the time vaingloriously proud. But now I present it to you as an oddity from a person I hope I've mellowed out from. Here's my title. O Pernicious Man, or The Urbane Acceptance of Incorrigibility, Being a Study of the Rhetorical Games of James Branch Cabell. I received sour comments from one of my assessors, an expert in American literature, who said he could not imagine why I chose to write about such a minor author. But it turns out that this early reading in Cabell introduced me to some much more sophisticated ideas than I'd realized at the time, besides also encouraging me to indulge myself in as many self-pleasing fantasies as I could, which was the unhealthy part of this. Cabell observed that the material facts of life consist of little more than being born, feeding, procreating, and dying. Human beings, possessed of the ability to imagine more beautiful and satisfying ways of life, will always strive to imagine better worlds to live in, or will construct imaginary patterns, that is, stories, to elevate and give meaning to their lives. For Cabell, this view led to a comic vision of life. Life as a comedy based on the irony that all the patterns and stories our imagination weaves are ultimately doomed to disappoint us. The pleasures and goals we hold out for ourselves, being imaginary, can never fully satisfy us in the real world. And yet, we are always creating these imaginative stories for ourselves. The motto of Cabell's fictional land Poitem is Mundus vult dissipi. The world wishes to be deceived. But it's time to let Cabell speak for himself. Here's an important little passage in which he sets out, much more elegantly, what I have just explained. I do not find the comedy ever to be much altered in its essentials. The first act is the imagining of the place where contentment exists and may be come to. And the second act reveals the striving toward, and the third act the falling short of, that shining goal, or else, the difference being negligible, the attaining of it, to discover that happiness, after all, abides a thought farther down the bogged, rocky, clogged, befogged, heartbreaking road, if anywhere. Thank you. I thought we needed a little music to break things up. And so why not Louis Armstrong and the Hot Fives and Sevens with a song from 1925, at the height of James Branch Cabell's fame, a song called Who's It? Who is it? Is what I'm dealing with the real thing or just my imagination? Yes, that's the essence of Cabellian comedy. This idea that we are all doomed to a cycle of disillusion and disappointment is certainly cynical. But if we can step back a minute and view our human condition from a distance, the situation can look a little different. First of all, we can then see our stories as stories, making our everyday existence more pleasant. Thus, as Cabell put it, everything in life is miraculous. It rests within the power of each of us to awaken at will from a dragging nightmare of life made up of unimportant tasks and tedious, useless little habits, to see life as it really is and to rejoice in its exquisite wonderfulness. The common names we call things by do not matter, except to show how very dull we are. We might recognize this as the New Age cant that we can create our own reality. But let's connect it instead to what Sir Philip Sidney, Samuel Taylor Coleridge, Tolkien, and others have called the power of our imagination to create finer and more real worlds than the merely materialistic world of our immediate senses. But we have to live in the everyday muddle of that materialistic world. We have to get the dishes washed, even though it's more pleasant to enter Harry Potter's world where a sweep of the magic wand takes care of the drudgery for us. What do we do then? We treasure the dreams, but also accept the facts of life. In other words, we compromise. The dishes have to be done. It would be better to imagine we had the power to magic these things away, but those dreams are for another time. In fact, it's my suspicion that if we can be aware of both things at once, on the one hand, what Cabell calls the boring and muddled facts of life, and on the other, the pleasing possibilities in the imagination, if we can keep both things in mind, we can then become more mindful of the facts of life as well as the way our minds are playing with the world around us. Thus, we are both more open to the world and to our own selves. That's the path of wisdom, isn't it? But alas, there's also the danger, which we must not sweep aside, and which, I'm afraid, Cabell seems sometimes to indulge in, the danger of turning our backs on the real problems of the world, choosing to see violent or hate-filled situations through more self-pleasing imagings. This is what propaganda would have us do, but we can do it for ourselves too. In fact, we often do it without even being aware of it. This can lead us to becoming smug and hard-hearted towards others. I don't mean to say that this smugness necessarily follows from Cabell's views, but only that we must be on the alert not to be seduced into such a dream-centered world. We need to be alert both to the facts and to our dreams. That's the balance of sanity. Hey, but remember, we're supposed to be talking about Cabell's novel Jurgen and the role of the devil in literature. Let's get on to that novel itself, then. Jurgen, a comedy of justice, is set in some unspecified medieval period in Poitiers and features Jurgen, a retired poet, now turned pawnbroker, making a living, as he would say, off other people's dreams. Let me read the first two pages just to set up the story and give you a flavor of the writing. It is a tale which they narrate in Poitiers, saying, in the old days lived a pawnbroker named Jurgen, but what his wife called him was very often much worse than that. She was a high-spirited woman with no especial gift for silence. Her name, they say, was Adelaide, but people ordinarily called her Dame Lisa. They tell also that in the old days, after putting up the shop windows for the night, Jurgen was passing the Cistercian Abbey on his way home, and one of the monks had tripped over a stone in the roadway. He was cursing the devil who had placed it there. "Fie, brother," says Jurgen, "and have not the devils enough to bear as it is?" "It hurt my great toe confoundedly," replied the monk. "Nonetheless," observes Jurgen, "it does not behoove God-fearing persons to speak with disrespect of the divinely appointed Prince of Darkness. To your further confusion, consider this monarch's industry. Day and night you may detect him toiling at the task heaven set him. That is a thing that can be said of very few communicants and of no monks. Then, too, consider his philanthropy, and deliberate how insufferable would be our case if you and I, and all our fellow parishioners, were today hobnobbing with other beasts in the garden which we pretend to desiderate on Sundays. To arise and lie down with the hyena? Oh, intolerable!" And thus Jurgen ran on, devising reasons for not thinking too harshly of the devil. Most of it was an abridgment of some verses Jurgen had composed in the shop when business was slack. "I consider that to be stuff and nonsense," was the monk's gloss. "No doubt your notion is sensible," observed the pawnbroker, "but mine is the prettier." Then Jurgen passed the Cistercian Abbey and was approaching Bellegarde when he met a black gentleman who saluted him and said, "Thanks, Jurgen, for your good word." "And who are you, and why do you thank me?" asks Jurgen. "My name is no great matter, but you have a kind heart, Jurgen. May your life be free from care." "Save us from hurt and harm, friend, but I am already married." "Sirs, and a fine, clever poet like you?" "Yet it is a long while now since I was a practicing poet." "Why, to be sure, you have the artistic temperament which is not exactly suited to the restrictions of domestic life. Well, then I suppose your wife has her own personal opinion about poetry, Jurgen." "Indeed, sir, her opinion would not bear repetition, for I am sure you are unaccustomed to such language." "This is very sad. I am afraid your wife does not quite understand you, Jurgen." "Sir," says Jurgen, astonished, "do you read people's inmost thoughts?" The black gentleman seemed much dejected. He pursed his lips and fell to counting upon his fingers. As they moved, his sharp nails glittered like flame points. "Now, but this is a very deplorable thing," says the black gentleman, "to have befallen the first person I have found ready to speak a kind word for evil. And in all these centuries, too. Dear me, this is a most regrettable instance of mismanagement. No matter, Jurgen, the morning is brighter than the evening. How I will reward you, to be sure." So Jurgen thanked the simple old creature politely. And when Jurgen reached home, his wife was nowhere to be seen. He looked on all sides and questioned everyone, but to no avail. Dame Lisa had vanished in the midst of getting supper ready, suddenly, completely, inexplicably. Nothing could explain the mystery short of magic, and Jurgen on a sudden recollected the black gentleman's queer promise. Jurgen crossed himself. "How unjustly now," says Jurgen, "do some people get an ill name for gratitude. And now do I perceive how wise I am, always to speak pleasantly of everybody in this world of tale-bearers." Then Jurgen prepared his own supper and went to bed and slept soundly. "I have implicit confidence," says he, "in Lisa. I have particular confidence in her ability to take care of herself in any surroundings." That little break was a short piece by Britten called Pan, and the devil, as in the tarot pack, is often depicted as a kind of Pan figure. That black gentleman, whom Jurgen meets was, we imagine, the devil. At the end of the novel, we discover he's someone a little different. But clearly, Cabell is drawing upon one of the conventional images of the literary devil here. In a turnabout from the usual Faustian convention, however, Jurgen does not sell his soul to the devil for some favor on earth. Instead, his vanity leads him to an elaborate praise of the devil, just a kind of poetic conceit. This is enough to charm the devil. People don't often praise the devil, who appears here as a rather sorry figure, grateful for any kind treatment. We are also in the midst of some sort of domestic comedy, the husband who feels his wife does not understand him, but nags him much of the time. How pleasant it would be for Jurgen to live without all that nagging. But when Jurgen arrives home to find his wife magically whisked away, he seems content to enjoy a quiet life. But his wife's relations badger him to do the manly thing and go in search of his wife. Out on a lonely moor, he finds her, or rather a ghost-like version of her, and she leads him into a cave. Dame Lisa disappears, but Jurgen encounters a centaur placed there to take him on to the next stage of this quest. We needn't go into too much detail about this quest, except to mention that early on the journey, Jurgen is given back his youth. He retains his 40-something mind, but is given back his 20-something body. Vigorous and, well, sexy. At each stage, Jurgen meets an attractive woman and seduces her, or she seduces him. The two of them get married, live together, and soon fall into a kind of domestic easiness. It seems unjust to Jurgen that real life cannot live up to the high hopes and deep desires he has for it, and Jurgen continues through the novel to seek justice. Justice would have the world itself match the desires of Jurgen's imagination. But it never will, as we know. And so Jurgen must compromise over and over again. He and his current wife remain fond of each other, but instead of sharing the deep passion they began with, they fall into a routine and become more concerned with everyday comforts and with the obligations of bourgeois social conventions. Who are we having dinner with this week? Then, for one reason or another, Jurgen moves on. Finally, Jurgen's quest leads him down into hell. Now, remembering that we constantly create stories to shape the boring facts of ordinary life to our liking, it should be no surprise to discover that hell is merely a construct of people's imagination. People with guilty consciences imagine there has to be a place where they suffer horrible tortures for their sins, and so such a place then comes into being. Jurgen is told that he has come to the hell of his fathers because his forefathers builded it in dreams, out of the pride which led them to believe that what they did was of sufficient importance to merit punishment. The demons Jurgen meets in hell complain that they are terribly overworked. They have to satisfy the demands of the souls who insist on being tortured, since being punished for having committed monstrous sins makes these souls feel more important. Jurgen proceeds to the deepest hell to have an interview with Grandfather Satan, who rules over the place. Satan, as Cabell describes him, was like a man of 60, or might be 62, in all things save that he was covered with gray fur and had horns like those of a stag. He wore a breechclout of very dark gray, and he sat in a chair of black marble on a dais. His bushy tail, which was like that of a squirrel, waved restlessly over his head as he looked at Jurgen, without speaking and without turning his mind from an ancient thought, and his eyes were like light shining upon little pools of ink, for they had no whites in them. So the devil here appears a little different from that black gentleman Jurgen had met earlier. He's less human-seeming. And yet when he speaks to Jurgen, he speaks civilly, like a gentleman. But Grandfather Satan has no real power. He is only the creation of Jurgen's forefathers with no validity of his own. He is not malicious, only a kind of public servant, giving people what he's been told by these same people to give them. He can offer Jurgen no justice. That's not his job. Finally, after ascending into heaven and sitting for a spell on the actual heavenly throne as God Almighty, and then later resuming his old 40-something body, Finally, Jurgen meets that black gentleman again, discovering that he is not the devil after all, but Koshchei, the immortal, who in Russian folklore and fairy tales is one of the deathless ones and seems to be associated in particular with abducting men's wives. Koshchei has created all things as they are, something he is neither proud of nor loves. All he can do is carry out the tedious task of managing the accounts of the universe. He is too busy to take any special care of events. The world is an indifferent place, and its creator is not particularly intelligent, as Jurgen is a little shocked to discover. Jurgen asks Koshchei to return his wife to him. "She was certainly very hard to live with," he says. "On the other hand, I had become used to having her about. I rather miss her now that I am again an elderly person. Indeed, I believe I have missed Lisa all along." And so, happy to do Jurgen one last favor, Koshchei turns back time to the moment he and Jurgen first met. All the adventures in the novel turn into an unreal dream. It was all just a story anyway, wasn't it? And life goes on for Jurgen just as it had been at the very beginning of the book. Jurgen reflects that at last he has found justice. His middle-aged desires are at home in the reality of a comfortable marriage. The best justice we will find comes from the necessary compromise between our imagination and the material world we live in. I said earlier that there was a scandal associated with Jurgen. Cabell wrote the book in 1919, a time when the wartime censorship was beginning to relax and writers could produce unconventional books without being prosecuted for unpatriotic disloyalty. The self-righteous persecution of any dissident views was just as virulent then as it was more recently under Bush's War on Terror. Cabell was deliberately trying to see how far he could go teasing the conventional morality. He got more than he expected. The book was selling moderately well until word got around that it had suggestive passages, such as those which I didn't read to you here, describing the lance Jurgen held in his hand in one of his marriage ceremonies, a lance with a purple tip, which he then placed inside an inverted triangle formed by the bride's fingers on her lap. You know, that sort of thing. The word on Broadway was, "Say, kid, get a book called Jurgen. It gets away with murder." Perhaps the worst affront was Cabell's poking fun at religion, still a dangerous thing to do in America. And it is a little scandalous, after all, to have your hero sit on the throne of God for a few minutes and then leave because he found it boring. Soon, John Sumner of the New York Board for the Suppression of Vice hauled the book into court on charges of obscenity. This was an important test case. The book could be saved from charges of indecency if it could be shown that it had been written with artistic intent. It didn't matter if those artistic intentions were carried out well or not. If they could prove that the book had not been written with the aim of turning people on, but for some artistic purpose, then the charge of obscenity would not stand. Literature, in other words, could not be judged for its morality. Here, in his own words, is the judge's decision. "The most that can be said against the book is that certain passages therein may be considered suggestive in a veiled and subtle way of immorality, but such suggestions are delicately conveyed, and the whole atmosphere of the story is of such an unreal and supernatural nature that even these suggestions are free from the evils accompanying suggestiveness in more realistic works." In other words, realism can be sexy. Fantasy isn't really sexy because it's not real. "In fact," the judge said, "it is doubtful," and this is the great line, "it is doubtful if the book could be read or understood at all by more than a very limited number of readers. In my opinion, the book is one of unusual literary merit and consists of nothing obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, indecent, or disgusting within the meaning of the statute and the decisions of the courts of this state in similar cases." So, when we think back on the important 20th century trials of books for indecency, Ulysses and Lolita are two that come to mind, Let's also remember Jurgen, the first victor in the battle of the artists against the censors. But what happened to poor James Branch Cabell? Suddenly he was famous not for having written fine literature, but for being the author of Jurgen, a dirty book. In the 1930s and on until his death in 1958, his name became more and more obscure. While he continued to write elegant little fantasy books for his own diversion and those of his limited audience. And even when, as a 16-year-old, I started carrying around Cabell's books, I was getting comments from older people who noticed the books. "Oh yeah, Cabell," they said. "He wrote Jurgen. Wasn't that the dirty book they used to keep on the top shelf of the library?" Cabell knew this wasn't justice. Yet what could he do but compromise and accept as gracefully as he could the oddities of literary reputations? You're listening to Evening Under Lamplight with your host, Robert Louis Abrahamson, on Cambridge 105, community radio in your city. We've spent a long time with Jurgen. Maybe you'll want to seek out the book. It's still in print, celebrated as a classic fantasy book, not as something obscene, lewd, lascivious, filthy, indecent, or disgusting. There's a good Dover edition, for instance. Dover books are always worth having, which contains the famous illustrations by Frank C. Pape. And these illustrations just border on the obscene and lewd, something like a more playful Aubrey Beardsley. Now let's move over to the photo album of Walt Whitman's Song of Myself. We're up to the third section of this long poem, a section with some important and resonating lines for us. First I'll read the section, then we'll attend to it. "I have heard what the talkers were talking, the talk of the beginning and the end, but I do not talk of the beginning or the end. There was never any more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age than there is now, and will never be any more perfection than there is now, nor any more heaven or hell than there is now. Urge and urge and urge, always the procreant urge of the world. Out of the dimness, opposite equals advance. Always substance and increase, always a knit of identity, always distinction, always a breed of life. To elaborate is no avail. Learned and unlearned feel that it is so. Sure as the most certain sure, plumb in the uprights, well entreated, braced in the beams, stout as a horse, affectionate, haughty, electrical, I and this mystery, here we stand. Clear and sweet is my soul, and clear and sweet is all that is not my soul. Lack one lacks both, and the unseen is proved by the seen, till that becomes unseen and receives proof in its turn. Showing the best and dividing it from the worst, age vexes age, knowing the perfect fitness and equanimity of things. While they discuss, I am silent and go bathe and admire myself. Welcome is every organ and attribute of me and of any man hearty and clean. Not an inch nor a particle of an inch is vile, and none shall be less familiar than the rest. I am satisfied. I see, dance, laugh, sing. As God comes a loving bedfellow, and sleeps at my side all night, and close on the peep of day, and leaves for me baskets covered with white towels, bulging the house with their plenty. Shall I postpone my acceptation and realization and scream at my eyes that they turn from gazing after and down the road and forthwith cipher and show me to assent exactly the contents of one and exactly the contents of two and which is ahead?" We begin here with a kind of rejection. Whitman's heard what the talkers were talking. They just spew out words. They talk of the beginning and the end. That is, their minds are set on the past and the future. They're not here with us in the present, but Whitman is. "I do not talk of the beginning or the end," he says. And why should he? He knows that life is right here. He invites us to live in the present moment. The present moment, the eternal now is the world free from the ego. My ego is always assessing situations, judging how the situation might make me look good, my eyes looking to how others are going to view me and how, sometime later, this is going to make me feel better, or if I'm not lucky, feel worse. I'm trying to control the moment and shape it so it suits my needs or my vainglory. But in doing so, I forget to notice the moment as it comes to me. I miss the moment. I am not living. And Whitman's goal is to celebrate life. Whitman, asking us to assume what he assumes, declares that he does not talk of the beginning or the end. He throws himself into the moment right now. What more do we need? Everything is here in the present moment, always the same thing, always changing. There never was any more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age than there is now, and will never be any more perfection than there is now, nor any more heaven or hell than there is now. One consequence of this vision, by the way, is that we can never say that things today are much worse than they used to be in the old days, or much better. There's no point in making comparisons. There will never be any more perfection, or imperfection, than there is now. And what characterizes this now moment? We get the great, restless, powerful lines, some say the heart of Whitman's sense of the world, urge and urge and urge, always the procreant urge of the world. This urge is the life force, the Holy Spirit brooding over the waters, the divine Zeus coming down to enjoy all the beauty he sees on earth. Living a vibrant life in the present, we join this constant urge, this desire to procreate. Yes, there's the sexual urge suggested here, but also something more universal. What is our procreant urge? It's surely not just that biological impulse to have children, though this is part of it. Human beings always want to create something, to make something of the world around us. It could be the urge to create a delicious meal, looking attractive on the plate even before we smell or taste it. It could be the procreant urge to go speak to someone across the road who looks a little miserable today. Always this procreant urge of the world, impelling us not to sit inert, not to take things for granted, but to interact and shape what lies in front of us, even if it is only to mess things up. Does this make sense to you? Do you feel that procreant urge in parts of your life? Of course, most of us are not strong enough or disciplined enough to rest in the present moment for long before our egos come back in and we start projecting onto the past or future. But I think if we consider those moments when we have been fully present, we will recognize that they are enlivened by this procreant urge. And then this image, which has always haunted me. Out of the dimness, opposite equals advance. Out of the dimness, the uncertainties, the confusion of life come opposite equals, the yin and yang, male-female couplings. There is no hierarchy. These are opposites, and they are equal. We need both for completion, for procreation, in fact. This procreant urge, it seems, works by bringing together opposites into a fruitful conjunction out of which will come something new, continuing the dance of life into the next moment. Always substance and increase, Whitman says. Always a knit of identity. I am I, and you are you, but we come together and knit together our individual identities, not obliterating our identities, since there is always distinction. And out of this coming together of opposites that retain their uniqueness even when merging with each other. Out of this comes always a breed of life, that is, always the next moment born out of this moment. I hope I'm making this feel very exciting. Do you feel the excitement? Can you sustain the excitement? I'm not sure I can sustain it for very long. I'm not too good at it. Perhaps only a few of us can keep up this knit of identity for long, especially if we have not yet begun to understand our own identities. But that's okay. Whitman stands here not as a taskmaster, but as a reminder of the possibilities. Whitman is not posing as a philosopher or a teacher. To elaborate is no avail, he says. We won't get it by having it preached to us or taught to us. And even what you and I are doing right here under lamplight is a kind of elaboration of the poem and thus, according to Whitman, of no avail. And he's right. These lines will make no sense to us until we ourselves actually experience this powerful breed of life in our veins. Learned and unlearned feel it is so. There's democracy for you. The experience is open to everyone. No one needs to be qualified to get it. "Aye, and this mystery, here we stand," Whitman says. And we too, I think, are standing by his side. As long as we can perceive that it is a mystery, we will be safe. Safe from over-intellectualizing, from killing the moment by trying to make full sense of it. And here are some examples of the way we can welcome these opposite equals advancing. "Clear and sweet is my soul, and clear and sweet is all that is not my soul. Lack one, lacks both, and the unseen is proved by the seen, till that becomes unseen and receives proof in its turn." I can perhaps see that my own soul is clear and sweet, but I cannot see your soul. Yet knowing that you and I are both in this together, opposites but equal, the clearness and sweetness of my soul is proof enough that your unseen soul is also clear and sweet. And then as your soul becomes seen by me, it helps me experience in turn how clear and sweet is my soul. Round and round goes the dance. But wait, Whitman takes us back to those intellectual talkers we had before. They are busy judging everything, showing the best and dividing it from the worst. This film was really good. This film didn't develop its characters well enough. I like that doctor who knew how to treat me. I reject that other doctor who didn't seem to even notice me. Where does this get me as I teach myself to accept some things, but to reject others? Whitman wants to accept all things for what they are, knowing the perfect fitness and equanimity of things. And so he will not waste his time in these judgmental proceedings. While they discuss these things, I am silent and go bathe and admire myself. Back to the world of the senses, admiring the beauty of himself so he can then look outward and admire the beauty in everything else. Welcome is every organ and attribute of me, and of any man hearty and clean. Not an inch nor a particle of an inch is vile, and none shall be less familiar than the rest. Whitman dares the Puritans to be offended. What, say the prudes, how dare you say that even that part of your body, you know which part I mean, is not vile? Of course it's vile. That's why we make you cover it up. Ah, says Whitman, but you see I do not cover it up. I become familiar with it, and thus I learn to admire it. I am satisfied. I see, dance, laugh, sing. And then this final image, which has puzzled many critics. God comes as a loving bedfellow to him, sleeping at his side until the morning, like Cupid, the manifestation of divine love, coming to psyche, the soul, only in the mysterious darkness of night. And in the morning, leaving behind baskets of bread to sustain him through the day, giving him this day his daily bread. All people coming to him come as God the loving bedfellow. And how can he turn from acceptation and realization, openness and gratitude, to calculation, trying to figure it all out? How could he kill the moment with analyzing it? Shall I, he says, shall I postpone my acceptation and realization and scream at my eyes that they turn from gazing after and down the road and forthwith cipher and show me to ascend exactly the contents of one and exactly the contents of two and which is ahead? Let's stop here now. I don't want to run the danger of gazing after and down the road trying to figure out the poem. I just want to share some of what I think is there for us both to enjoy. And so, as is our custom, we end this session by experiencing the poetry one more time, pure and in itself. I have heard what the talkers were talking, the talk of the beginning and the end, but I do not talk of the beginning or the end. There was never any more inception than there is now, nor any more youth or age than there is now, and will never be any more perfection than there is now, nor any more heaven or hell than there is now. Urge and urge and urge, always the procreant urge of the world. Out of the dimness, opposite equals advance, always substance and increase, always a knit of identity, always distinction, always a breed of life. To elaborate is no avail. Learned and unlearned feel that it is so. Sure as the most certain sure, plumb in the uprights, well entreated, braced in the beams, stout as a horse, affectionate, haughty, electrical, I and this mystery, here we stand. Clear and sweet is my soul, and clear and sweet is all that is not my soul. Lack one, lacks both. And the unseen is proved by the seen, till that becomes unseen and receives proof in its turn. Showing the best and dividing it from the worst, age vexes age, knowing the perfect fitness and equanimity of things. While they discuss, I am silent and go bathe and admire myself. Welcome is every organ and attribute of me, and of any man, hearty and clean. Not an inch nor a particle of an inch is vile, and none shall be less familiar than the rest. I am satisfied. I see, dance, laugh, sing. As God comes a loving bedfellow and sleeps at my side all night and close on the peep of day, and leaves for me baskets covered with white towels bulging the house with their plenty. Shall I postpone my acceptation and realization and scream at my eyes that they turn from gazing after and down the road and forthwith cipher and show me to assent exactly the contents of one and exactly the contents of two and which is ahead? And here we are, come to the end of our evening under lamplight. Thank you for attending and for sharing with me all these wonderful things, all these procreant urges. Get in touch with me at rla@momentsunderlamplight.com or on Facebook and find our podcasts at momentsunderlamplight.com or the Cambridge105.fm site or as an iTunes podcast. So many choices. I'm Robert Louis Abrahamson, and this has been Evening Under Lamplight on Cambridge 105. Come back next time for further engagements. And we'll see each other out with this unusual track from an album called Miles from India, an adaptation of some Miles Davis pieces, performed by Indian musicians, blending Eastern and Western traditions. It's a good last thing at night piece of music. Good night. Thank you.